Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 215 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe as a podcast. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing 701-719-0990. You can also call the PRN.fm voicemail at 862-800-6805. Leave a message, leave your name, and make sure you indicate that the question is for the infectious myth. And remember that dialing either of these numbers may incur long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it, or what you don't like. If you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. I do really love to hear from you, my listener. Don't be shy. You can make a one-time donation to the expense of the show via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com or monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on one of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. And now for a little bit of feedback. Heather, by email, wrote, "Thank you for your podcast on measles. I've experienced some of the same reactions as you with the measles hysteria here in Washington State. You cannot have a sane discussion about the topic. The first thing I bring up is that heart disease is killing more people than measles. Actually, a lot of things. I've also stated that you're going to trust the same companies that brought us the opioid epidemic. I've even got more blunt when I say my whole class had chickenpox, and that wasn't declared a public health problem. I've also found it interesting how the story keeps changing on the news. I think here in Seattle, somebody traveled to Hawaii, then it was Ukraine. And now the local Walgreens is advertising, get your MMR shot on the billboard. I do not think people are going to be rushing out to get a measles vaccine when our economic problems and growing homeless problem is huge here now. I was also harassed on my Facebook about my measles view by some grandmother, or at least she said that's what she was, who accused me of spreading misinformation. I actually said that pushing forced vaccines was insane and sick for someone with my health problems. It would be like me taking penicillin when I have an allergy to it, giving me a reaction of hives and giving me an asthma attack and killing me. I felt this should be left between me and my doctor. Although she said she was a grandmother, it felt like I was talking to some kid in Silicon Valley or some think tank or government person. She unfriended me after I included a link to a DOD study on bioweapons and vaccines in 2002 passed by the Bush administration after the anthrax attacks. Thanks for your good work and including actual data." I wrote to the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions, which put out a proposal promoting pharmacare, i.e. the Canadian government should pay for drugs prescribed to Canadian citizens. I agreed that people should get the drugs they need, no matter their economic circumstances, but I asked whether the policy was going to be balanced with more attention to the already high level of people being harmed or killed by pharmaceuticals due to unexpected drug reactions, drug errors, and so on. In the U.S., this is somewhere from the fifth to the first leading cause of death. Think of the opioid crisis, which was started by prescribing practices with painkillers. Pharmacare can hardly reduce our consumption of pharmaceuticals, can it? It also can make drug treatment seem like the cheapest alternative, even if it's not the safest and most effective. This is the response I got from them. "Thanks for reaching out regarding national pharmacare. This particular focus on side effects, prescribing errors, etc., is not one that we have done a lot of research on. We have focused more on the cost-related barriers, faced by people trying to access needed medications. Sigh. What will be the next big drug crisis after the opioid crisis? It seems like a very narrow-minded approach. But of course, it's of financial benefit to nurses, which do a lot of the distribution of drugs, if not the prescribing. Let's go to this week's interview. It seems kind of incredible, but the City of Vancouver in Canada defunded the longest-running and very well-known rape crisis center in the city. And we're going to go back to our previous guest, Megan Murphy, of the Feminist Current in Vancouver, to explain how and why this happened. Megan Murphy is a Vancouver-based feminist who's been on the show before. The first time, just after she was banned for Twitter for insisting that a woman is a biological female. Now there's news that Vancouver Rape Relief, I hope I got the name right, has been defunded by Vancouver City Council because they insist on serving only biological females, aka women. So can you talk a little bit about Vancouver Rape Relief in Vancouver, how long it's been around, what the importance is of the organization?
Right. So Vancouver Rape Relief is Canada's longest standing rape crisis center. And they've been operating, I think, since 79 or 80. So a really long time. They serve, you know, thousands of women every year. They operate a rape crisis line and also a transition house for women and their kids. So, and not only have they been operating a transition house and rape crisis line to help women for so long, but they also do a ton of public education work. So they've been putting on, for example, the Montreal Massacre Memorial event every single year.
Can you remind a lot of listeners are not Canadians, so they might not remember that massacre. And actually, there's been a couple in Montreal, so I shouldn't laugh. So, it's not funny at all.
So the Montreal Massacre took place in 1989 in Montreal at an engineering school called École Polytechnique. And the gunman walked into the school and went into one of the classrooms and separated the men from the women and then made the men leave the room and then shouted, "I hate feminists," and started gunning down women. And I believe he killed 14 women. And so, you know, this was a specific attack against women in the engineering school, because engineering was always a male-dominated realm. And I think the background of it was that he hadn't gotten into the program. And so he felt, you know, angry that these women who, in his mind, were not truly meant to be there, were there taking up spots that he felt he should be entitled to. And, you know, he shouted, "I hate feminists." So it was specific attack against women and feminism.
Yes. Often there's an implication that when a man walks in and kills several women, that it was misogyny. But in this case, it was overt. There was never any question that was the motivation for the attack. So they every year they commemorate this attack, or I don't know if that's the right word, but
right. So every year in December they hold a public event. It's free. It's open to everyone. It's accessible. And they have speakers in and have panels and show documentaries, all centered around violence against women and working towards ending male violence against women. And, so they do those kinds of events. They recently had an event for International Women's Day, featuring Winona LaDuke and a number of other local and Indigenous activists, also free to the public, accessible. So it's not just a transition house, it's not just a rape crisis line, but they're also political, and they've also been, you know, heavily involved in fighting for feminist laws in Canada. You know, for example, Canada's prostitution laws, which criminalize the purchase of sex, and decriminalized women in prostitution. They've been really involved in the inquiry into the missing and murdered women here. So they do really important work. They, you know, they bring women together. There's a community in Vancouver of radical feminists, thanks to Vancouver Rape Relief. So they're quite important in this movement here in Canada in particular.
Yes. I think they're a very well-respected organization due to their long history. Two things of the city funding is like, how important was the funding? And then there's the symbolism of the city supporting an organization, which is kind of a stamp of approval of the work. So was it a lot of money that the city was contributing to this organization, first of all?
It was a $30,000 grant, so it's substantial. It's not going to, you know, end Vancouver Rape Relief. They're going to continue to operate. This specific grant was for public education. So this supported their public education work, particularly like these events that I just talked about. I mean, it is, you know, that's still a lot of money. You know, that's like, you know, almost a person's salary. So, I mean, if you're making not very much money, but,
well,
you know, obviously...
maybe I've jumped ahead because I didn't... we didn't talk about the reasons for the city council voting, I believe, unanimously to end funding for VRR. So can you explain why they ended funding for what seems like a well-respected organization?
Right. So what happened, actually, I just wanted to clarify because I was like, I should double check when Vancouver Rape Relief was founded. So I just Googled, and the shelter was actually established in 73, and then they've been operating the transition house since 83. So a very long time. In any case, so what happened was, as far as I can tell, this initiative to defund Vancouver Rape Relief at the city level was led by Morgan Auger, who is a local man who identifies as a trans woman. Well, he actually identifies as female, according to his Twitter profile. He's male for his whole life until I think he maybe transitioned or began to transition 4 or 5 years ago. He's one of the vice presidents for the BCNDP here in our province in British Columbia, which is, it sounds important, but it's actually not a very important position. There's a number of vice presidents, and it's an unpaid, it's a volunteer position. So I think he kind of likes to throw it around as some kind of high power position, but it's not really. But in any case,
but the NDP is the governing party of British Columbia.
NDC, yeah.
Yes.
So, and the NDP doesn't seem to be disciplining this person in terms of their public behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of women have complained about his public behavior because he engages in libel all the time, and he's constantly going after feminists and women who are critical of gender identity ideology and who want to ask questions about the laws surrounding gender identity. For example, that, and this is of course related to the defunding, the notion that if a man, for example, announces that he is female, he should be automatically allowed into female spaces, like locker rooms, like washrooms, like female prisons, but also, of course, women's transition houses. So back in 1995, I believe, a trans woman named Kimberly Nixon came to one of Vancouver Rape Relief's training sessions where they're training women to become counselors in the transition house. And of course, the women running the program could tell that Kimberly Nixon was a man, and so told him, you know, sorry, this training group is only for women. They operate on a peer counseling basis, which means that women who've been to the transition house, like as victims of violence, can later train to become counselors, to counsel other women who come in later. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's also like Vancouver Rape Relief understands that growing up female in a patriarchy is a particular experience, and they think it's important that their counselors understand that experience. And there are no men allowed in the shelter. Also, this is a place for women who are escaping male violence, so they want there to be a space for women to heal away from men. And so they told Kimberly Nixon that, unfortunately, he couldn't train to be a counselor. And Kimberly Nixon took them to court and tried to, you know, sue them for discrimination. Vancouver Rape Relief won that case at the BC Supreme Court and the federal level. And what they won was the right to define their own membership and who they offer services to. So as an oppressed group of people, as a group of women who have historically been oppressed, they're allowed to determine their own membership, just as, for example, a group of Indigenous people are not obligated to invite white people to join their organizations or groups, and they're allowed to offer services specific to, for example, you know, Indigenous mothers or something like that. So it's the same law that would be applicable to both those kinds of groups. You know, if you want to offer services to immigrants, that's okay. So Morgan Auger has always kind of had it out for Vancouver Rape Relief and uses this woman-only policy as an excuse to claim that they discriminate. You know, so...
Right. Yeah, I mean, I guess I can see the logic in a sense, in that, you know, in the last 40, 50 years, women have managed to get into previously male-only spaces. But that seems to be on the basis that some of those male-only spaces were centers of power, like golf clubs were where business was conducted. So if women weren't allowed in golf clubs and they were in business... That was a real deficit, but on the other hand, there are a lot of organizations where you're trying to, that have like a church or something has people of a particular type that are, you know, you're limited maybe to services if you're a member of the faith or whatever. I guess what I'm saying is it seems reasonable to me that women or immigrants or Catholics should be able to have organizations that are limited to that defined group, because you're not talking about a power dynamic.
Yeah, and I mean, like you say, a lot of the sort of men, the places that women were kept out of were places where, you know, that, you know, there was power to be accessed. Universities, for example, political realm, but also, you know, like on the grounds that women weren't supposed to be in public spaces, that they were supposed to be in the home. So, you know, women used to not be allowed in bars and things like that, even unless they were prostituted women. And in this case, particularly, the reasons behind the women only spaces is not just for political organizing purposes, but because it's a safety issue. So, you know, women are at risk of violence at the hands of men, not at the hands of other women in general, for the most part. So we're not just, you know, like keeping men out of those certain spaces, like locker rooms, like bathrooms, like transition houses, like female prisons, where women are particularly vulnerable, is really a safety issue. Whereas, of course, men aren't in danger at the hands of women, so there's no reason why men would be afraid of women entering into men's spaces, per se.
Right. Yes, I mean, it does seem, particularly in this case, that a woman who's been traumatized by a man should have the right to be in a woman-only space for the time to heal. Obviously, the world, when they go back into the world, that's different, but to have... that space makes perfect sense to me. So when did you know when Morgan Auger started to try to push this idea of defunding VRR?
Not really. I mean, he's been talking about this kind of thing online forever. On Twitter, he's constantly saying that, you know, he's constantly saying Vancouver Rape Relief is breaking the law in Canada, and so they shouldn't be able to have charity status and receive funding. They're not breaking any laws in Canada. They're on the right side of the law. In fact, as I said, they won this case at the Supreme court. So they're well within their rights in Canada to, as I said, define their own membership and who they offer services to. So again, this is more libel that this person is posting constantly. So he's been talking about it for a long time. And then I guess there was a call out on his social media, which an ally of Vancouver Rape Relief saw, saying, you know, I'm going to be speaking at this city council meeting against Vancouver Rape Relief and trying to get this amendment enforced so that grants cannot be offered to organizations that serve women only. And he advocated.
Well, he would probably put it differently because he classifies himself as a woman.
So he probably would, but the language actually that was in the amendment was to cross out the word woman and change it to persons. But yes, of course, he's claiming that it's about serving all women, and he's saying that he's a woman and that anybody who identifies as a trans woman is actually a woman, which is, of course, not true. But the language itself was changed in the grant from women to persons.
I interviewed a previous guest who opened the first male domestic violence center in Canada, and you know, when I was talking to him, that was before it had opened, he was saying that there's no place for male victims to go. But if you change the Vancouver Rape Relief to take out woman and put in person, then a standard man, you know, heterosexual man could just say, I want to be served by this organization, which would open the doors much wider than just transgender women.
Right. I mean, Vancouver Rape Relief is not accepting this, but so they're going to continue to serve only women. But yeah, I'm not sure what the end result here is going to be. And, I mean, I think it's fine for men to have male only transition houses, if that's something that men who are victims of violence feel that they need. I suspect that most of those male victims of violence would be victims of other men. But fine with me.
Yes. Well, I don't remember. I certainly don't support the idea of having, unisex domestic violence shelters. That doesn't make a lot of sense. And as you point out, it's much more of a problem for women who tend to be smaller than men and therefore more easily victimized just from the sheer size differential. So was it a unanimous vote at Vancouver City Council to do this?
It's a bit complicated, so I think there was a couple city council members that didn't support the amendment, but I found the whole thing a bit confusing when the actual vote went down, so I can't speak to that for sure. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, the vast majority voted in favor of this amendment. So, you know, and I mean, part of the other issue is that, so this meeting was happening and city council members were aware that Morgane Auger and a number of other trans activists were going to come and attack their funding. And nobody informed Vancouver Rape Relief to say, you know, this is going to be up for discussion. This is going to be up for debate and we're having this vote and come and defend yourself. Vancouver Rape Relief luckily found out at midnight the night before of the meeting, again through this ally who had seen Morgane Auger's post on social media, so they were able to come and defend themselves, and they defended themselves quite powerfully and eloquently, but City Council, of course, didn't support them in the end.
Have any city councilors defended their position publicly?
A number of members have, you know, made statements on Twitter speaking out against so-called transphobia and, you know, kind of Vancouver Rape Relief should get with the program and accusing them of things like, you know, they keep getting accused of excluding so-called sex workers. I don't use that term. I use the term prostitution. I don't think that sex is work, but, that's absolutely not true. They don't exclude prostituted women at all. They've helped, you know, countless prostituted women at their organization. It's just ridiculous. And they do, you know, if a trans woman calls their line, they support that person person and help them to find the services they need. They just can't house that person alongside women. So it's not even that they don't, you know, the women who work at Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, I'm quite certain have helped and supported many, many, many more trans women in this city than any of these politicians and activists have in their lifetimes.
I was, while I was doing some background research on this, I came across the story of Christopher Hambrook. Do you know about that story from Toronto?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, well, the summary that I got is this was Toronto Sun, which is maybe not the most reliable source for these things, but he declared himself female, calling himself Jessica. And under that name, he sexually abused a 5-year-old girl, raped a 27-year-old intellectually challenged woman. And then he stayed at a Toronto women's shelter where he sexually assaulted a woman who was both deaf and homeless and sexually assaulted a survivor of domestic violence. The Toronto Sun wrote that he falsely claimed to be transgender, but if gender is by self-declaration, there's no such thing as a false declaration of being transgender.
Yeah.
You say it and it's true. And he was sentenced as a dangerous sex offender, so that probably means he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail, unless he can show that his sexual desires and violence and other criminal behavior have been resolved. But it seemed like an illustration of the danger that there is in opening up these spaces to a biological male.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I've heard that a number of times before where trans activists will say, or, you know, the media or whoever will say, oh, well, that person's not really trans. He's faking it. It's just a man who's like pretending to be trans in order to, I don't know, get away with that stuff. But the very arguments of the trans activists are, of course, that anyone at all who claims to be a woman is a woman. So there's no, you know, there's no clear definition of what transgender means. There's no, you know, test. There's no way of assessing who is truly trans and who is not, because, you know, that word itself has not been defined in a clear way. But of course, yeah, all these laws and policies and the ideology itself says that sex is based purely on identity. So, you know, if this Chris Hambrook person says he's a woman, then he's a literal woman, and we all have to accept that no matter what. That's their idea. That's what they're pushing for, and that's what they want. So it's sort of a weird thing to claim. But yeah, it does seem to be that there's more and more examples of violent offenders who are deciding that they want to identify as women, whether that be to be transferred into female prisons or sort of to escape accountability once they've gotten out of prison.
When I first heard about bathroom bills, it was, you know, pretty strong conservatives in the U.S. who were saying, you know, men are just going to access these spaces in order to abuse women. And, you know, being kind of progressive, I thought that was kind of crazy, but they were actually right. It doesn't mean that every transgender person that gains access to female spaces is going to abuse people, but it has happened more than a couple of times. And it's interesting that we have, as maybe noticed this last time, this alignment between conservatives who have their own reasons for opposing, transgender rights to female-only spaces, and feminists on the other side who tend to be more left-wing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want me to talk about those differences, or?
I mean,
feminists who are challenging gender identity ideology and legislation are challenging it on a couple of bases. One being that feminists see gender as a set of stereotypes that are largely sexist, that are imposed on people based on their sex. So when a little girl is born or a little boy is born, immediately there's socialization that starts happening. So people treat baby girls and baby boys in different ways. At a certain point, boys are usually discouraged from, you know, being emotional and told not to be wimps and encouraged to play with different kinds of toys and, of course, wear different kinds of clothes and things like that. And similarly for girls, they're encouraged to play with dolls and wear dresses and sort of be polite and passive, and it's more acceptable for women to, or women and girls to be emotional and things like that. And so it's not that, you know, whether or not all gender related traits are socialized or innate or connected to evolution, I think that there's some complexity there. I don't think that it's all black and white, but you know, there are a lot of stereotypical gender traits that have been assumed or imposed on people over history that have ensured that women have not had equal rights, have not been able to participate, again, as I mentioned earlier, in the political realm. You know, they were seen as too irrational, too delicate, things like that. They were supposed to be in the home, taking care of babies and cleaning the house and things like that. So, you know, we don't see gender stereotypes as a particularly good thing. And we challenge the idea that men and women have to be a certain way. So we don't believe that all men are necessarily inherently more aggressive or violent or rational or unemotional than women are. And we don't assume that all women are inherently drawn to dresses and makeup and high heels and, you know, making babies even.
Right.
And of course there's like some biological stuff going on there, of course, but you know, right. It's not, you know, people are different. People have different personalities. They do have different behaviors and different likes and dislikes. And some women like wearing dresses and some women like wearing pants and so on
right.
and so forth. And so we challenge the idea that's offered up to us through gender identity that says, actually, no, gender is inherent. And if you're born with these supposedly inherently feminine traits or masculine traits, that's what determines your sex. So if a male is more drawn towards femininity, then that must mean that he's actually a woman and he's been born in the wrong body. So feminists tend to find that idea a bit offensive because we don't feel that our womanhood and our the fact that we're women is rooted in these stereotypes. We think it's because we have a female body and that's how we were born and that's what makes us women, not, you know, our makeup or our hairstyles or whatever.
Yes, to me a lot of things can be explained on the difference between the individual and the population. If you take the average of a particular trait, men and women may differ, but that doesn't mean that there is actually a much huger difference between individuals. So it could be that women would never achieve the same on, say, the assertiveness scale as men in general, but that doesn't mean women can't be assertive.
Right.
It's and people confuse those two things, and I think that's how stereotypes come along, because more of this group are like this than that, then you kind of assume everybody's like that. And people make generalizations about men and women often in jest, but I think that's sort of based on population observations, which are a combination of history, of the imposition of expected roles, plus what people desire, what people choose.
Right. And I mean, and I should add, the other thing is, the other issue that feminists have with this gender identity ideology is, again, the right to organize on a political level amongst ourselves. So feminists understand women to be an oppressed class of people under patriarchy, and on that basis argue that women have the right to gather amongst themselves to strategize and to advocate for various changes and things like that, and not to be obligated to necessarily include men in that organizing.
Yeah, and it would seem reasonable to me. There are problems that are also bad, frequent in men, such as suicide. I believe it's higher in men. So a group that was to work with, boys who were suffering from suicidal ideation, to me, would not be a bad thing as long as women had access to something similar, right? If you only supported men, then that would be a problem. But to have male-only spaces or female-only spaces, because that seems like the justifiable, doesn't, I don't have a problem with that.
Right, like it seems to me that it would sort of make sense that there would be plenty of occasions where a man might feel more comfortable talking to another man, in terms of whatever the issue is, whether it's abuse or whether it's mental illness and various kinds of support. I think that's fine. I mean, obviously, just because women are oppressed in a particular way in a historical sense, it doesn't mean that men don't suffer as well and need support as well.
Right. Did you hear about the case of Carolyn Farrow, a journalist in the UK, who was investigated because of malicious communications, which sound like a similar crime, if I can use that word, to yours on Twitter of referring to a transgender child as a boy? The child was the child of Susie Green, who runs an organization which appears to encourage transgender transitions. And I'll just quote a couple of things Susie Green, pardon me, that the journalist Carolyn Farrow said. She said, "Susie Green may feel that giving her son off-label illegal medication at the age of 11 and drastic surgery, that was at 16, was the path of least harm in her circumstances, but she shouldn't project and impose it on other vulnerable kids as best practice." And she also said, "I think it's time everyone called out Susie Green and her organization, Mermaids, for what they're advocating, which is child abuse."
And Susie Green seems to have a pattern now of doing this kind of thing because Susie Green also was the one who went after Posey Parker and had the cops show up at Posey Parker's house, who's an activist in the UK, for and Posey Parker similarly criticized Susie Green and Mermaids on Twitter for transing kids because it is I mean I certainly don't think that it's a good idea to put kids on hormones and or puberty blockers and subject them to these surgeries because the adults of the world have determined that, boys can really actually be girls, and the way to prove that they're actually girls and to validate this so-called gender identity is to stop them from going through puberty and cut off their body parts.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny that we've come through a time where people finally all agreed that female genital mutilation was bad. And I wish they would do the same about circumcision. That's another subject which I consider also genital mutilation. But I guess one would say that if you're 18 and you want to go through ritual, female genital mutilation, that's your choice, but it's normally done to a minor who has no say in the matter. But now we're encouraging minors, or some people are encouraging minors to have hormones or surgery, which I do feel is child abuse, especially if the child changes their mind later in life.
And I mean, what child is in a position to determine something like that? I mean, kids say all sorts of things like, "I'm an elephant, I'm a bird, like, I want to be this, I want to be that." Imagine if we just validated every single thing that kids said, and this is quite serious. I mean, if you start putting kids on these hormones, you're on a path to kind of ruining their entire life, like it sterilizes kids, and it means that they
Yes.
don't develop properly. Like humans are supposed to go through puberty.
Right. There was in the article I read on Carolyn Farrow and Susie Green, there was a link to a YouTube video in which Susie Green was chuckling about how small her son's penis was because he'd been on hormones during his puberty, which I just thought was really sad.
Yeah, I mean, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing happened to, I don't, are you, have you heard of Jazz Jennings?
Yes.
Yeah, so I Am Jazz, another famous so-called trans kid. And when Jazz went to finally get his surgery to turn his penis into a replica of a vagina, I suppose is the intent. Although, of course, a vagina is not just a hole inside a woman's body, it's attached to organs and has a purpose.
Right.
But he didn't have enough, let's say, material in order to complete the surgery. I guess they eventually figured it out, but it was a difficult surgery because he had been on hormones, so he hadn't even developed properly, and so his hope of having the surgery was almost dashed because of the impact on the hormones in his body. And I don't know. I mean, I just find the whole thing really sad and disturbing. And we don't even have any long-term research on all the negative impacts that these hormones have on kids' bodies as they grow to become adults. But certainly there's the risk that at a certain point this child will become an adult and change their mind and say, you know, oh, I actually am male. This was just a phase I was going through, and then it's too late, and their body's ruined for life.
Yes, I came across a group of four young women who had all declared themselves transgender and then after some time had all desisted or decided that they weren't. And I don't know if they all eventually decided that they were gay or they just, decided that they were happy with their female body, but they all decided not to proceed. Are you have you heard about what's been happening to Navratilova, the former U.S. tennis champion?
Yeah, of course.
It's pretty big news.
I mean, and actually those girls that you're talking about, I'm assuming you're talking about the Peak Resilience
Yes.
Project. Yeah. So I talked to one of them, Dagny, for the podcast. I haven't published the podcast yet, but I talked to her a couple of weeks ago, so that was really interesting.
Oh,
She's
okay.
quite articulate, and yeah, I mean, she I think she transitioned for a couple of years and was on testosterone for a little while and wore chest binders and things like that, and eventually realized this wasn't for her and that this whole thing was having a negative impact on her life and her body and things like that, and realized she was just female and that's fine, and she's a lesbian. And you know, she got out of there fairly unscathed, but her voice has been altered for life, and she still has some trouble breathing, and some issues. She has reduced lung capacity as a result of wearing these chest binders. So, and you know, she didn't wear them even for that long, but yeah, she has reduced lung capacity, less lung capacity than she did when she was a teenager, now as a young adult. Yeah, Martina Navratilova, am I saying that right?
Navratilova, yes.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, of course, as you know, a tennis legend, and dared to suggest that it was unfair to allow males to compete against female athletes, you know, simply because they declare themselves female. I think that the policy nowadays, and most recently the policy that's being adopted by sports bodies around the world, is that a male can reduce his testosterone for a year and then declare himself female and compete as a female against other female athletes. And you know, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Reducing your testosterone for a year doesn't alter your body to make it
Right.
the same as a female body. And men, of course, will still be stronger. They have bigger bones, they have bigger organs, they have more muscle mass, you know, they're taller, like it's just and on and on and on.
Navratilova was expressing support for Caster Semenya, who's, I think, a South African woman, who's clearly a biological woman who happens to have high testosterone level. So, because the sports have said what defines a woman or a man is their testosterone level, Caster Semenya has been coerced into, or they're trying to coerce her into taking hormones to lower her testosterone level if she's going to continue to compete. She appears to have like some kind of intersex condition, which left her with a higher testosterone level, which makes her a fantastic runner, but she's still clearly a biological woman. I found that sports started by saying, you know, we're going to stop men from running in women's sports by looking at their genitals. And then secondly, they said to look at their chromosomes, and now it's testosterone that defines a woman.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that testosterone is not relevant. And the situation with Castor is, I mean, it's complicated. And I'm not an expert in intersex conditions. I mean, the only people can determine the situation with Castor are people who are doctors and who are experts in this area. I'm under the impression that Castor has internal testes too. But the situation with intersex people in sports, I think, has always been complicated, but that's always sort of been a private matter determined by doctors and experts in sports and things like that. And I think it's a bit silly for that to be kind of up for public debate, because none of us really, you know, we don't have the, I don't think we have the private medical records of Castors. And how do you, I'm not sure to say.
Semenya. I don't know. The most interesting case I came across was a Spanish woman who had the paperwork to say that she was a woman, which apparently in sports is needed, but she showed up at an international meet without it. They did a genetic test, and they found that she had XY chromosomes, yet she was a woman. And apparently what can happen is you know, the normal process doesn't happen at birth. So the signals that the genetics send to say you're going to become a man don't happen, and she developed into a woman. But she was accused of being a man, but she wrote an article in The Lancet in, I think, 1995 or 2005, and she said, I am a woman. I have breasts and I have a vagina. I am a woman. And that's, I think, when they ended chromosome tests, because they realized they're not entirely reliable. But
yeah, I mean, the chromosome test might not be that useful. I mean, the testosterone tests are, of course, still necessary because of doping and things like that. And if a woman did start taking testosterone, then she would have an advantage over those other women.
Right,
so
right.
It is important that women competing have a certain or are under a certain level as far as their testosterone goes, which is probably why there's part of the reason why there's an issue with Castor. The thing with actual clear males is that if you have gone through puberty as a male, then you're going to have that different male body and all those physical advantage attached to that. And yeah, there's no reduction of testosterone as an adult that will change all those advantages that you got through the process of going through puberty as a man. And it's just insane and ridiculous that anyone is arguing that just reducing your testosterone for a year will change your male body.
And I think it's going to lead to gaming the system. I know that people will temporarily reduce their testosterone low enough that they can get in, but they'll train with a higher testosterone level. I can just see this happening. The reason I was interested in it is because sports has tried to grapple with this question of what is a woman because of women's sports. And it seems like, to me, where they started, that a woman is a woman because she's physically a woman, was the best place. And I can't really see testosterone being that reliable of a marker when you're dealing with people like Semenya, who naturally have high testosterone levels. And you can't level the playing field so that everybody who's in sports has the same advantage as somebody who sits on the couch all day, right? I read a comment on a web page about transgender people in sports, and I think this was the most sensible response that I saw. He said, even if a child starts taking hormones at a very young age, they would still have some male advantage, and they would suffer huge health consequences for doing that. And if you grow up to be, say, 14 or 16 and then start to transition, the lower testosterone doesn't mean that you have a woman's body. It just
right.
seemed sensible.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, that's Let's get back to VRR. What is the plan in terms of, is there a proposal to try to get the city council to reverse this? Is there activism happening?
I'm not sure if Vancouver Maple Leaf themselves are trying to challenge it in any way. I'm not part of the collective. I don't work there, so I'm not on the inside of their discussions. But I mean, they received, after this happened, they received an outpouring of support from all around the world, and people were just livid. Like that, I you know, Morgane Auger posted on Twitter what happened after it did, and the list of comments underneath his tweet was just never ending, with people saying, like, you're a horrible person, this is appalling, like, don't you have anything better to do with your time and energy than take money away from women who are supporting women who've been subjected to the most horrific violence? So people have been donating, and I'm sure that Vancouver Maple Leaf has probably made up at least some of that loss via these donations. And
But the
I mean,
rejection by their own city, I mean, that seems like the symbolism seems maybe more important than
exactly.
the
I mean,
money.
it's not just about the money at all. Like I said, Vancouver Maple Leaf will survive without this grant. They'll be fine. But the fact that the city took away funding because they only serve females is really just repulsive. I mean, these people, it's awful. And it was awful, I watched the meeting from home on my computer, and it was just so depressing to see. There was a couple of trans women, Morgane Auger and another one, whose name I don't remember. But then there was also like a few young, kind of like, they probably identify themselves as queer, young queer women, in their 20s, just trashing and smearing Vancouver Rape Relief and advocating for them to be defunded. And I just thought, like, what the hell do you think you're doing? You're advocating against yourself. I mean, if something happened to you and you need somebody to call, Vancouver or somewhere to go, Vancouver Rape Relief is one of those places that you could call and go to support. And you're advocating, you're trying to get them shut down and trashing them when what they're doing is they're helping women, and they're here for you. And I don't know how young women have been so twisted around to think that they should support males who want access to female spaces,
Well, I think
opposed to
that's one,
supporting themselves and other women.
right? That's one thing that I've learned is the perspective of a woman like yourself who sees men invading their spaces. Like as a man, having biological men in women's washrooms didn't affect me in the least. But I hadn't seen it from the perspective of a woman. And, I believed the progressives who said nothing bad could happen from this. And so I think I've learned a lot through talking to you and other people about some of the downsides of this. It's not going to be easy for city council to back themselves out of this in the current environment.
No. Well, I mean, yeah, and these politicians who are going along with this are all, leftist, so-called progressive politicians, and it seems like they've just fully taken up this gender identity thing, and who knows what they really think. Who knows if they're just going along with it because they feel they have no other choice, or because they feel like it'll gain them political support or social support or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it seems that the left has really been swept up in all of this and is sort of going along with it. And it's hard to say why. It's hard to say how this happened, where these few activists, it's not very many people who identify as transgender, and transgender activism is still, as much as it's dominating discourse, this is happening. This is just, like a minority of people who are advocating this idea that it's possible for men to become women and it's possible to have some kind of internal gender identity. et cetera, et cetera. But they've really taken hold of the left and leftist politicians.
And my position is that not that I want to deny their existence or their right to exist the way they want. The question is what accommodations are made for them. Do they get everything they ask for, or do we have a discussion about what's reasonable? And I think we've shot past that discussion.
Right, exactly. I mean, I want all people to be able to live lives that feel authentic and fulfilling to them. Certainly, I don't want anyone to be subjected to harassment or violence or discrimination, but I absolutely don't believe that in order to protect people from harassment and discrimination, we need to go along with this, you know, really incoherent, regressive, sexist ideology. And we certainly shouldn't have to put women at risk and take services away from women in order to accommodate this minority of people who believe they're the opposite sex or desire to be the opposite sex or whatever. I mean, I feel like people should wear whatever clothes they want to wear and, you know, feel free to wear makeup or have long hair or not or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if you absolutely feel you must get surgery, then I'm not going to stop you from doing that. I think those are pretty serious surgeries that should be considered.
Right.
And especially when, obviously, when we're talking about kids. But, you know, it makes no sense to me that we need to say trans women are literally female in order for people who identify as trans women to feel like they have the services they need and to feel safe.
I mean, I don't object to people having that position, but it seems to be, I have this position, and if you disagree with me, you're a transphobe.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want a debate on this.
And not just you're a transphobe, but it's turning into, if you have this position or you're challenging my ideas, it's hate speech and you're like guilty of hate crimes. You know, that's what people like Morgan Ogier are saying over it. Like Morgan Ogier is really trying to push through this idea that, you know, feminists like me and Vancouver Rape Relief are guilty of hate crimes and hate speech. And it's just ridiculous.
Yes. Well, we're coming to the end. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this discussion?
No, I don't think so. Thanks so much for covering this. It was good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to talk to you too, Megan. Goodbye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to episode 215 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.